The title is a book, the title I pinched of this talk is the title of a book by Leighton Ford called How to Give Away Your Faith. It's a know-how book on simply talking to your friends. I got converted at the age of 16, nearly 17, and the people I grew up with in that church, they took it for granted that everybody would make an effort to speak to their friends about Christ. I didn't think that was a strange thing because I'd been led to Christ by the kid who sat next to me at school. We had cheated our way through exams together until after the Easter of our third year together, Dick Tisher came to Christ at an Easter camp and he stopped cheating. That made quite a difference to my marks. What we'd done up till then was we had tended to shove our papers across after we'd finished them. We both worked fast at everything. We would check each other's work and then slide it back again for reworking. In mathematical subjects, we got very good marks, and it will not surprise you to discover that we both got the same marks. Why our teacher never discovered that, I don't know. As an ex-school teacher, I'd have smelt a rat at that moment straight away. However, after his conversion, he stopped cheating. Whether he intended to tell me or not, I don't know. I said to him, "Whatever is the matter with you?" He said, "I became a Christian last weekend, mate, and I'm not going to cheat anymore." I said, "I've been a Christian for years and years. What's cheating got to do with Christianity?" I said, "I've been cheating all my life." He said, "You wouldn't know a Christian if you tripped over one in the park." And so, you see, his subtlety was ideal for me. He was the sort of man I understood. What amazes me about Dick Tisher was he was a Christian for such a short time, and his understanding of Christianity was minimal, but he did not stop to run the flag up for the cause. I don't know if there was any other Christian in my class at school, but none of them identified themselves, and he gave them plenty of opportunity to do so. So I've always assumed that he was the only Christian in our class. I've also thought of myself as being enormously lucky that I was the man who sat next to him. I didn't think when I became a Christian there was anything odd about me speaking to my friends about Christ, because that is the way I came to Christ. You always think that is normal, don't you? Whatever way you've come to Christ, you think that's the norm. Unless, of course, you've come in such extraordinary circumstances. I won't walk down that path. I made efforts to talk to people about Jesus with minimal knowledge. That is very difficult to do, isn't it? And it didn't take me very long before I realised there was quite a lot of homework needed to be done. I went away on a weekend conference. There were lots of Christians and non-Christians at it, and the talks were very good indeed. And a girl said to me, "Are you a Christian?" I said, "I am." She said, "Can you tell me how to become a Christian?" So minimal was my knowledge, I couldn't even stutter out what I believed as a Christian. If I'd had more time to think about it, I could have said the Apostles' Creed. That would have been a good beginning, wouldn't it? Because I knew that. I'd learnt that from church. I said, "No, I can't tell you how to become a Christian, but I can take you to somebody who can." And I took her to this friend of mine, and she said, "Can you tell me what I've got to do to become a Christian?" And he, with consummate ease, led her to Christ before my very eyes. It was for me a breathtaking moment. Suddenly I realised there were people who'd done their homework and were ready for such an event. I was both excited because she'd come to Christ, and I was mortified because I'd been a total failure. And I remember saying to God in my prayers that night, "Trust me, such an occasion as this will never, ever happen again. I will learn what to say and how to do it." Now, no one had put me through a course. No one had even thought to put me through a course. There were no courses available. Nobody had written them. The idea that you could take a course in learning how to speak to your friends one-on-one had never occurred to anybody to do that. One of the really breathtaking things about the 59 Billy Graham crusade was that 11,000 people in Sydney were trained to be counsellors, and they used a little tract called Peace with God, which enabled them to go through a gospel outline. It is hard to imagine the impact of 11,000 people let loose in the community of Sydney with a small, simple tool which enabled them to share their faith with other people. It was probably the single largest lasting effect of that crusade. I know lots of people came to Christ, but I think that may have been more significant. Only time will tell in the judgment seat of God. Okay, so the first thing I'm talking about is do some homework. And in the homework, the first thing is to make sure you know what to say. If somebody says to you, "What is at the heart of Christianity?" or "How do I become a Christian?" can you give them an answer? Now, you can do that without getting into conversation. It's one of those things you can do early in the morning when you're trying to work out if you're going to get up or not. It's one of those things you can do while under the shower. There are loads of times in the life of people which don't require much thinking. You don't think a lot under the shower about what you're doing. If you find you're in the position, you say, "I wonder what piece I'll wash next," I think you need more help than we can give you. Okay? So when you're under the shower, say, "What would I say to people if I got an opportunity? Somebody came to you out of the blue and said, 'I'd like to become a Christian.' Can you tell them what they ought to do? Can you tell them what they ought to believe?" Now, it might be that you don't get very many opportunities to do that because you're not prepared. God just keeps people away from you so you won't muck them up, if you don't mind me putting it so crudely. Okay? And do some homework. Say, "Be like me. So I'm never going to let that happen. I'll never be caught on the back foot again on what homework I can do." In 1 Peter 3, he says, "In your heart set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to anybody who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. Do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience so that those who speak maliciously against your good behaviour in Christ may be ashamed of their slander." These people were under terrific persecution. And Peter is writing to encourage them to keep their end up and not give up as Christians. And he's saying, reverence Christ as Lord in your heart. That's basically Christian, isn't it? Say, "Well, I'm following Jesus as my Lord." Then he says, next thing is, be ready to give a reason as to why you are a Christian. Be ready to give a reason. And he said, do it with gentleness and respect. Okay? You ought to treat everybody with gentleness and respect simply because you're a Christian. I mean, that in itself. Try to behave like a Christian because you are one. That's a great help, I think, don't you? And the other thing, too, is Do you know what to say? Now, I don't have time to teach you now. But if every time somebody asks you, you've got to try and dredge up the last sermon you heard, it's really hard work, isn't it? And I've taught myself an outline that I can do on my hand. God, people, God, what if you do, what if you don't? See, that's not very hard to remember. God, people, God, what if you do, what if you don't? I was driving along South Dowling Street one night. I'd been speaking at a meeting in the Cross, and it just started to rain. There was a bloke hitchhiking. Well, I thought this might be an opportunity for the gospel, mightn't it? I'll give him a lift. I stopped the car. I said, "You want a lift, sport?" "Yes," he said. "It's not much fun walking in the rain." I said, "Get in." Now, if I'm ever going to speak to him about Jesus, I've got to take control of the conversation, don't I? The number of times people ever walk up to you and say, "Good sir, what must I do to be saved?" are so rare that you can just about discount them. And he's not going to ask me how he can become a Christian. I've got to put that proposition to him. So I must start talking. Remember, in evangelism, it's basically about talking. So if you're not a good talker, it's time to start practicing. When you go to buy the paper next time, see if you can say a sentence as well as passing over your $1.20. Okay? Make up a sentence you can say. Try and get into conversation. And try and do more than the normal Australian monosyllabic grunt. You know, Okay, see if you can make up a sentence. Now, if you're like me, who goes on all the time like a married magpie, it's not difficult for me to speak. I'll talk about getting to the gospel in a moment. Now, here is the bloke in my sights. I'm praying for an opportunity to speak to him, and I know I've got to take the initiative. So I say, "What sort of a night have you had?" "Anything will do, but I've got to take control." He said, so. That's gone nowhere, has it? That's fallen flat in its face. I say, "Well, that's life, isn't it? You win a few, you lose a few. I must start again." "What do you do for a living?" He said, "I'm a stuntman in movies." I said, "You've got to be joking. Honest?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Don't waste my time. Talk." I said, "I've never met a stuntman in movies. You might be the only one I'll ever meet. Talk. Tell me about it." Well, of course, he raved on about it. And he said, "You know what, after about 10 sentences he hadn't drawn for a breath, he said, "You know what it's like to be on the third floor parapet and jump out into the net and you're not sure whether you're going to make it or not, and the adrenaline is pumping through you." I said, "Stop it." I said, "The adrenaline's pumping through me and I'm flat on the ground." "Oh," I said, it frightens the living daylights out of me just thinking about it. "Start again, chapo, that's finished." I meant to say to him, "How long can you be physically fit to keep doing this work?" But to my great surprise, I heard myself saying, "What is the life expectancy of a stuntman?" Well, he gasped a little bit and I said, "No, that's not the question I want to ask. The question I want to ask is, how long will you be physically fit to be able to do this?" He said, "About 35, I think." I said, "Strike." I said, "Can you amass enough money to retire at 35? Anyway, all the time I'm praying that we'll get to the gospel, and nobody is more mindful of the fact that I'm light years away from it. But I'm talking, that's a start. Out of the blue, and I'm praying that I'll get a chance to say the gospel. But I'm not going to walk all over him. He says to me, "What do you do for a living?" Now, does this appear to you like a God-given moment? I said, "I work for the Anglican Church." He said, "Doing what?" Well, I said, "They actually pay me to try and persuade people to become Christians." He said, "Are you for real?" I said, "Deadly earnest, mate, deadly earnest." He said, "They actually employ people to make up the numbers." I said, "Yeah, quite a lot." He said, "I never knew that." I said, "Didn't you?" He said, "Are you any good at it?" I said, "I win a few, I lose a few." He laughed and said, "That's life, mate, isn't it?" I said, "That's life." Now, at this stage, if you're anything like me, you say, "Well, I've had my opportunity and I've blown it. But can I trust God to keep pushing the door open? Can I trust him, or do I have to have a nervous breakdown?" See, I often say to people, when the perspiration starts to come out on the palm of your hands, it's better to bust than do anything. Just do nothing at that stage. If you're so uptight at that stage, everything that comes out will be all uptight. And he'll be all uptight too. Relax. He said, "How would you actually go about doing it? Well, do you think this is the God-given moment?" I said, "People invite friends to come and have dinner with us, and they invite me to talk to them about Christianity." I said, "What do you say to them?" I think this is the moment, don't you? I think if I chicken out now, I'm a complete fizzer. But I know what to say now. I said, "I've got a little talk that's got five propositions. This is God's world. He made it. And he's put Jesus in charge of his world. And Jesus has the right to run our lives." And he said, "What is the second proposition?" I said, "The second proposition is none of us want that to happen. We all say to Jesus, 'Rack off, leave me alone. I want to run my own life my own way.'" I said, "The third one is that God keeps saying to us, 'Stop it, don't go on like that. It's serious, change your ways.' And the last two are, what will happen if I do change and what will happen if I don't? If I submit to Jesus, I can be forgiven and I can start again. And if I won't, I'll get it in the neck in the end." I said, "That's fairly reasonable, isn't it?" I said, "Seems like eminently good sense to me." But he didn't fall down and say, "The Lord, he is the God." I'd like to tell you it was a wonderful success. But I can trust God with him. I've told him in the best way that I know what can happen. And I won't be the only Christian he ever meets. That's the first piece of homework to be done. Second piece of homework is to start praying that God will bring you to people that you can talk to about Jesus. Do you do that? I'm sure on your prayer list each day, you've got people you're praying for that'll come to Christ. I'm sure of that. If you haven't, you're way behind the eight ball. Start doing that. Okay, that's basic and fundamental. You're praying for people that they'll come to Christ. For me, the members of my family, and for my brother Jim for more than 50 years. It's hard not to lose heart, isn't it, after 50 years? He's 80 and his attention span's about 3 seconds. You've got to have a really good gospel outline to belt it out in 3 seconds, trust me. Okay, I'm glad I told it to him when his attention span was a quarter of an hour. Okay, start praying that God will bring you to people and that you'll recognise the moment when it comes along. One of the nice parts about prayer is you can't hide from God and you ought not to try. So I've just come clean with God and I say to him, "Look, most times I'm terrified witless. So will you bring me to people I can handle? And give the really hard cases to the Archbishop, who seems to be able to handle them all right. And leave the ones I can handle to me." And I think that's why Pete gets difficult ones to do, because it's an answer to my prayer. And I say, will you also make it crystal clear to me when a good opportunity comes? Now, do you think God will honour that prayer? He won't mock me, will he? He wants me to do it. And I've come clean with him. That's where I am. 9 times out of 10, I'm scared witless. But every now and again, I get into a situation and I know the gospel's got to be said. I remember coming down from Sydney University one day in the bus. The bloke put his foot on the brake and a lady roared straight down the aisle and was embedded in me. You know, I pulled her out. I said, it's like hitting the back of the bus, darling, only a bit softer, isn't it? She said, my husband has drawn $600 a month for the last 8 months out of a joint account. What do you think he's doing with the money? Do you think that's a gospel moment? Got to be, hasn't it? She's really saying, tell me the gospel, please. She doesn't know she's saying that. But that's what that request means, isn't it? I said, you sure you really want to find that out? I mean, it might be worse knowing than it is not knowing. And she's getting off the bus. I whip out a little tract I've got called What is a Christian? I said, if I were you, I'd start praying if you don't already. And here's a little thing that might help you. That's the best I can do. I've got to trust God for the rest. Okay? But you can see that's got gospel written all over it like a neon sign going. There'll be other times when you'll be able to do it. So start praying for people. Okay, think about the sort of questions you think they're likely to ask you. And see if you can think out the answer to it. So that when it comes up, you're not sort of groping around. It's so hard to think on your feet, I think. And especially when I'm excited. They start talking to me about Jesus. There's not a butterfly in my stomach. It's a great eagle flapping around inside. Trying to keep your wits clear at that stage is hard work. I know I want to have done my homework. So what sort of things will they ask you? Tell me the sort of things they've asked you. And by the way, this is not rhetorical. I'm looking for an answer. Okay, what sort of questions do your friends ask you? Yeah? Yes. How is it possible that Jesus is the only way? If God is all-powerful and all-loving, why doesn't he stop suffering? Okay? Do you have to go to church to be a Christian? Isn't it all psychological? You just need a crutch to hold you up? And I don't know why anyone should think that was a strange thing. The answer is yes, I think I do. I think I was made to be on spiritual crutches, wasn't I? Wasn't I designed that way? Anyway, there you go. And so on and so on and so on. Now, 95% of those there's an answer for. Don't let that ever throw you. And don't be frightened to say, I don't know the answer. But I'll find it out. That's a great question to be asked. Because it gives you immediate entree next time to talk to them. Okay? There might be some questions for which the answer is not very good. Then you've got to show why you go on believing when you don't seem to have all the best answers. Okay? But for 90% of them, there's an easy enough answer because I don't think I'm a gullible twit. And I still don't think I am. I wasn't one when I became a Christian, and I'm certainly not one now. I've had a lot of time to do my homework. Okay? Now, those are sort of things that can all get done, and you could train yourself, or if you think you couldn't do that, put the bite on the staff here that you pay, get your money's worth out of them. Make sure they teach you. That's their job. Okay? And so I'd do that. Now, there's the first thing, get the homework done. Next thing is start speaking. Okay? You can always work out whether the bloke in the train wants to speak to you. Okay? I always start speaking to the person I sit next to. I say, g'day. If he goes, that's fairly clear guidance, isn't it? I don't need it any clearer than that. I pull out my book and go, All right? On the other hand, if we can get into conversation, we might get to the gospel. We might. We don't always and invariably, but I'm certainly not going to get to it if we don't start speaking. Okay? So start speaking to people. And the burning question is, can you get from the weather or the footy to the gospel? Thank you for correcting the spelling error. I once had a psych essay handed back to me in third year, and it said, my dear Chapman, your spelling has ceased to be a weakness. It is a complete failure. I thought that was relatively rude. True, but rude nonetheless. I have been known to spell the same word differently three times on a page without recognising it. And I would think that's probably a world record. I've looked in the Guinness Book of Records, but there doesn't seem to be an entry for spelling. How am I going to get to the gospel, which is where I want to go? Try and teach yourself to think Christianly about the world, so that in normal conversation about anything, you can say something Christian. Now, 6 months ago, was in London. We had a training day, not unlike this night. And I said, what do you think will be first on the news tonight? Well, I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to the news this morning. But yesterday, what would you have thought? What was top thing on the news last night on telly? Do you know what was first on? Can anyone recall? Iran's statement about wiping out Egypt. Israel. Okay. If somebody got you into conversation about the Iran statement about Israel, can you work your way from that through to the gospel? Now, you need to stop and think about that, don't you? Sometimes it's easier than others. Well, anyway, at this conference, we were right in the height of Katrina. And so this man said to me the following day, I gave your idea a bit of a burl this morning. He said, I was with one of the partners. We were waiting to go into a meeting. And I said to him, have you ever stopped to think why people prey on other people in times of distress? He said, I was watching on television last night in the aftermath of Katrina. You've got people just looting and stealing other people's property. He said, I suppose it's because they're so poor. But he said, they're stealing it from poor people. They're all in the same boat together. And he said, I don't know, I've never thought about it. He said, I just think it's a strange phenomenon that in times of distress where you'd think people would be coming to other people's aid, they take the opportunity just to prey on them. He said, I think there's something terribly warped about us to behave like that. Now, see where he's heading? He's on to sin before you can say, Bob's your uncle. And if he gets an opportunity to go much further, he'll talk about the solution to it. But he's pulled himself up out of the mess, and he said to a bloke, Have you ever stopped to think about? I lived in a block of home units in Penshurst, and the young man who lived opposite me was quite friendly. He was a young school teacher. He was quite friendly to me until he saw me one day with a dog collar. And he became decidedly cool after that. He was frightened that I was going to evangelise him. He was correct. I was going to, at any and every opportunity. But he was so scared, he used to run past me on the stairwell. And I felt a bit sorry for him, but I wasn't going to let up nonetheless. I heard him going out to put out his wheelie bin, so I thought I'll give this a run, see if there's wheelie bin evangelism in the next book I'll write. So I got my wheelie bin and followed hard upon the. So the two chariots are racing towards the curb. To his horror, and mine too, I may say, somebody had chopped down a tree in the park opposite our place. It was lying half across the road. And he was so angry, he got into conversation with me. He said, "Have you ever seen anything like that?" I said, "I've seen worse than that, but it's bad." I thought, this is probably the one opportunity in a million, chappos. See if he can do anything. So I went for the jugular. I said, "I think that's probably what happens when people give God the flick." Well, he was so stunned by that remark, he said, I don't give a fig about God, and I don't go around chopping down trees." And I said, "But you would if you felt like it, wouldn't you?" He said, "I don't feel like it." I said, "No, that's beside the point." I said, "Don't you do whatever you like?" He said, "By and large, yes." I said, "Well, that's what he did." He said, "It's stupid to want to chop down trees." I said, "I agree with you. But you ought to allow him the same rights you've taken for yourself, shouldn't you? What makes you right and him wrong?" He said, "Everybody knows you shouldn't chop down the tree." I said, "Apparently not." I said, "The great trouble with saying goodbye to God is might is right. And that is obviously not right." I said, "I want you to know that you really frighten the daylights out of me." He said, "You've got nothing to be frightened about with me." I said, "Indeed I do. If you decided to take me on, you could beat me hands down in a way. It's why I've been thinking I'll get a gun and learn how to shoot it. Because we can't work out what is right and what is wrong, can we? If it's only a matter of what you like and what I like, who will win when we don't like the same thing? And we are in complete wash at the present moment because we've said goodbye to the only one who can say what is right and what is wrong." Well, that nearly sent him into orbit. He almost became the first Australian astronaut with nothing to help him. And he walked off in high dudgeon. I'm not the only Christian he'll ever meet, and he'll see plenty of vandalism between now and the end of his life. And I've just shoved a thorn up into his heel and let it fester away. And every time he sees vandalism, he'll know that I think somehow it's got something to do with belief in God. Now, that's a long way from the gospel, but that's the best I can do for now. And I'm not God. I can't do more than I can do. And that's the best effort I can do on that subject. But if you don't practice thinking about it, it'll be really hard when the event comes. A great friend of mine that I'm going to visit in hospital, who I think is dying with cancer, at one stage he and I read the editorial of the Herald and rang each other at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and said, "If somebody spoke to you on this subject, have you worked out how to get it to the gospel?" He was good at it. He taught me more about doing it than I ever knew. And we just tried to do some homework with that way, often in conversation. To think about where you are with your friends. What is it they're always talking about? Can you throw something Christian in? And if they don't run with it, don't beat your breast and commit suicide. It's a bit like fly fishing. You don't ever catch anything in fly fishing. It's getting all the gear ready and wading up to your waist in water and throwing it out and winding it back in again, throwing it out and winding it back in, throwing it out. And then you come ashore and you have a couple of sandwiches and a thermos of coffee, and then you get climbed back into your gear and do it again. It's the fishing part that's more fun. Every now and again you catch something, which I think has probably been a trout that was unlucky enough to swim across the hook as you dragged it in. Sometimes I've seen them hooked in the back of the tail. It's hard to think he was doing anything back there. But I think this sort of evangelism is a bit like that. Give it a try, and every now and again they'll run with it. Okay? The other thing too is, if you're serious about it, make sure you've got something for people to read. Little tract that you liked. So look, if I'd got my wits about me, this is what I'd like to have said. Now, because I couldn't find one I liked, I wrote one myself. And you always flog your own stuff because you think it's brilliant. If you've been trained to be modest about it, you think it's quite good. But if, like me, you're unrestrained, you think it's brilliant. And you flog your own stuff like mad. And so I wrote a little booklet called What is a Christian? I've written a bigger book called A Fresh Start. Not a month, this is written first in 1981. Not a month has gone by that I don't hear of someone who's come to Christ by reading it. And that's a funny thing about writing a book, because you're miles away from people, you don't want to be interrupted. And by the time you finish it and it goes to the publisher, about 9 months has gone by and you've forgotten what's in it. And then it's a great surprise. I got a wonderful one from a guy called Cosro. He said, "Dear John Chapman, my name is Cosro. I am asylum seeker. I live in Scotland. I'm given your book, A Fresh Start. It is nice. I give it to the man next door." When you write a book, it is for all the world, not just for Australia. So please tell the meaning of following phrases. I look them up in dictionary and cannot find. I ask at work and they laugh me. Poor Cosro. What is meaning of pain in the neck? It escaped poor Cosro. I sent his 3 pages of Australianisms to the editor and asked him what he would like to do with it. The best part about talking to people about Jesus is you're not on your own and you can trust God. Does God want you to get embarrassed? He doesn't. Does God want you to get into situations you can't handle? He doesn't. He's for you. He's not against you. You used to be against him once, but that's come to an end. He's on your side. He's got the situation, every situation in hand. And what he wants us to do is to be faithful in the situation we come to. Is God a trustworthy person? Yes. Is he going to lead you up the garden path to have you chopped off at the knees? He is not. And for me, in doing one-to-one evangelism, trusting God, I've got to keep saying to myself over and over again, there's no need for you to have a nervous breakdown, chappo, on this. You know, if you hear yourself saying, "I'll speak now or bust," it's generally better to do the latter, because it'll all be mangled when it comes out. Okay? Now, there's time for you to ask me a question. Do you want to ask a question? I know that what I've said is fairly generalised and not specific, but getting your homework done and asking God to bring you to people you can handle is at the very essence of what I'm on about. Do you want to ask a question or make a statement? Want to do that? Here you go. Yeah.
John Jones is making a good use of himself because they're so intrusive.
Yes.
And they don't seem to recognise you as a fellow Christian. And they're so argumentative, I guess, that they get with a too bad, a bad name. Is there a point at which we Christians can go too far that way? Sort of be loud.
Well, I don't want to be an objectionable person because I think I'm not one. And I don't like people when they are objectionable to me. So if you follow the rule, treat other people in the way you'd like to be treated, it's unlikely that you'll make a terrible mistake. It's unlikely. Okay? It's one of the reasons why I personally don't do much door knocking. The last time the JW man came to me, I felt so sorry for him, I had to help him. I think it was his first visit, and I was inside the wire door, and the lady who was coaching him was giving him last minute instructions, as if I couldn't hear through the wire door. So when he knocked on the door, I opened the door and I said, "Good morning." He said, "I've come with a message of much joy for you." I said, "Dear man, you're very welcome here. I could do with a bit of a lift this morning." I said, "A message of joy. Tell me the message." He said, "It's from the Bible." I said, "Even better. A message of joy from the Bible. Make my day." He said, "I'll read it to you." I said, "Please do." He said, "Here, the first and great commandment is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord, the God, He is one. And you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul and strength." I said, "Is that the message of joy?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Don't ever come with a hard message, will you?" I said, that fills me with dread. He said, "Why?" I said, "I can't do it." "What?" he said. I said, "I can't love God with my heart, mind, soul and strength. Can you?" He said, "No." Well, I said, "It's not a message of great joy, is it? It's a terrible message." He said, "We just got to do our best." I said, no, it doesn't say that. It says you've got to love God with your heart, mind, soul and strength. But I said, there is a message of great joy in the Bible. So when you go to the man next door, I'll show you a better place to go. If you open your Bible at 1 John 1, right up the back, and read me verse 7. "If we confess our sins, God is faithful and just, and He will forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness." I said, "That is good news, isn't it?" "Yes," he said, "it is." I said, "I'd mark that in your Bible so it's easy to find." But I said, "Skip that one about loving God with your heart, mind, soul and strength, unless you want to send us all to despair. I want to know how I can get out of the mess of not loving Him. And I'm a man for forgiveness. So give that one a flutter and see if you do any better." Well, he went on his way. Whether he was rejoicing or not, I don't know. I normally don't want them to knock on my door. Okay? I always spend a lot of time talking to them because it stops them talking to anybody else. That's the basis. If they've got free literature to give away, I always take it because it means they can't give it to somebody else. Okay, that's where I'm at. But I don't want you to be objectionable. The last thing, if we've come to Christ and we're living life to the full, we ought not to be objectionable people. We just oughtn't to be like that. I take it that's why that quote says we are to do it with gentleness and respect. I keep thinking about what I was like before I was saved. And most of the people I'm talking to are just like me. And I want them to be like I am now. My own view is that at any given moment it's very difficult to work out where a particular person is. So you cannot be a postmodernist through and through. You can't stop at any street corner and say, "I think the bus will stop here." It won't. You can't be postmodernist at that level, okay? So at any given moment people are a mixture, and I think only in conversation will that become true? But fairly early on, if you can get to say the words Jesus or God, if you can drop those words into the conversation, Jesus is much better than God. Because God means lots of vague things, but Jesus doesn't have that same sort of movement. People often will tell you where they're at, and I think you've got to adjust then. The other thing I want to say to you is, you probably are a child of your own age. And so you'll be postmodern in a way, or you'll have had to deal with that before you came to Christ. Okay? Do you want to follow that up?
No.
Okay, righto. He is now retired because he is my age. He ended up being Professor of Science Education at Melbourne University. He was very clever. He was also President of Sydney University's EU. Lucky, wasn't I? I was very, very lucky. Bro? I'm sorry, brother, I'm very old and I'm also hard of hearing. Well, I think you will probably have to learn something about comparative religions because everybody thinks they're all the same. You see the muddle our federal government gets into with multiculturalism. Because they're basically humanists, they don't think anything matters in religious thinking. Suddenly they discover Islam does. Christianity is so weak in our country that it doesn't matter what you say, there'll be some Christian person who'll agree with it. Doesn't it? You see, we've lost our cutting edge because we're so muddled. But in Islam, they think it's perfectly all right to chop your head off if you won't believe. And we think that's not human. And especially if you're a humanist. And I think it probably would be good to show that they can't all be right. I keep saying to people, I don't think they are really all the same way to God. They can't be, can they? I mean, we've got things which are fairly basic disagreement. Buddhists don't really believe that God is there at all. I think that is a big difference, don't you? And I say, and Muslims don't believe Jesus is God. And we think that you can only be forgiven because of the... I think there are big differences. I think Islam is very different to us. My friend who emailed me from La Trobe University said, I've been reading through Mark's Gospel with half a dozen Islamic boys on the campus. He said, we will get to chapter 10 and the death of Jesus yet again. We're reading Mark's Gospel. He said, they cannot believe that a human could be God. They cannot believe that our sins are so bad that they could only be dealt with by the death of Jesus. So I emailed back very quickly and I said, does it mean that Allah is not all powerful? He cannot become a human. I would have thought if he's all powerful, he must be able to do that. I said, as with the second one, what is the explanation for evil in the world? It's obviously bigger than, it's not a little thing. It's enormous. But they don't have a concept of loving people. And the concept of loving your enemies, they think is insane. It's part of the way we've learned to live in our community. We think forgiving people is important. they think forgiving people is madness. That is a big basic difference when it comes to living with them. Yeah. But I tell you what, brother, most Australian people are ignorant about what most people believe. They're humanists by and large, and they'll take on board the humanist ideals. At least I think they are. And so you don't have to read a lot to know more than them. Do you know Tony Payne's book, The Man Next Door? His work, is it The Man Next Door? On Islam? Yeah, in our backyard. About the bloke whose daughter is going out with a Muslim boy. And he's terrified about it. And he talks to his neighbour about it. And it's an expose of Islam. And finally, the Islamic boy stops taking her out. And he writes to a dad and said, I can't take your daughter out any longer. She's so godless. Yes, Islam in our... Yeah, good on you, buddy. Good on you. It's a good read. Even I could follow it. Okay? Yeah. Anybody else? There's time for one more question. Yes. I've written a book called Know and Tell the Gospel. In it I've addressed that question about doing a gospel outline without using technical language. I want you to train yourself to do that. In fact, everything I wish I'd said in the last hour is written in the book, by the book. Okay? And what's more, it's not a bad read, even I admit it myself. Setting Hearts on Fire is a book I wrote about putting evangelistic talks together. And A Sinner's Guide to Holiness is everything I know about holiness. Okay, that'll do, Andrew. I've had enough.